Mr. Devison, Mr. Withers, my Chinese, distinguished Chinese colleague, ladies and gentlemen. Before I get into this, I thought I'd try and sum up what is happening in India by means of a small example. This concerns a friend of mine who started a company something like 7 years back, a little over 7 years ago. And she had two other partners, three of them, each of them stumped up about $5,000 each. And they started the company. The company's aim was fashion designing. They were all three very creative people. And of course, as happens when you start a company, they were a little apprehensive. Would it take off? Would it not take off? And like a true friend, I played my role. I pointed out how difficult it was going to be. But I also told them, look, one client will always be with you. And I like to imagine that that's what really set it all off. And they started. In 7 years, they have grown at between 100 and 200% a year. And last year, their turnover was in the millions of dollars. It's a good job the friend was my wife too. So I'm the unworthy beneficiary of the largest that she extends to me from time to time. I can't afford her fees anymore. But in their spare time, they do a little bit of work for me as well. That, in a way, encapsulates the sort of changes that are taking place in India today. There's an enormous amount of energy which has been unleashed by a number of changes. You hear about the unleashing of the private sector energy. It's certainly a reality, and a very powerful reality. It's coupled with a whole lot of other changes, for instance, in the nature of our financial system, in the nature of our corporate governance laws, in a whole host of other things, the sanctity of contract, and of course the fact that there is a booming middle class which is emerging, which is the largest in the world, 350 million people. Now that is the backdrop to the sort of things that we are going to have a brief look at, because I realize that we are a little pressed for time. Here is a chart which shows the sort of growth rates that we have been clocking. The first period, of course, is the period of British India. And you can see that what is not going to be news to anyone, it's not good to be ruled by foreign people. And you see in the last 4 years, we have clocked 8%. And in the last, from 2005, 6, and 7, which is the year just ended, it's been over 9% in each of the 3 years. Correspondingly, we are noticing the population growth is slowing down, which is again something which you see all over the world. With rising incomes, population growth rates start to taper off. And frankly, people talk a lot about the demographic dividend in India because it is a very young population. 55% of the population is under 25 years of age, and 75% of the population is under 35 years of age. But I tell you, I look to the day when we'll be 1.6 billion with pure dread. I think we can't afford that kind of number, not just because of the strain on resources, but because they all have to be educated. Otherwise, they are just going to be a drain on the economy. That is one of our biggest challenges, educating these huge numbers of people that are adding to our population. But again, the good sign is that it is working pretty well. We have a law which requires every child to be educated. It started out, it's a very interesting history, it started out as an attempt to educate the girl child. And then one of the lawyers pointed out that that could be taken to the courts as gender discrimination, and so it emerged as a law which would cover every child. We do get 100% of the children at the primary stages in schools, but what we have found is that the dropout rate is pretty high, and sometime around class 8, there has been a bit of a dropping off, say about 30%, which is 30% too many. And efforts are now being made to make sure that that is also addressed. Well, here's a reference to the middle class. Now, here we have something which, in a way, meshes in with the anecdote that I began with. The drivers of growth, you see the difference between the India model and the more traditional East Asia or the Asia-Pacific model, started by Japan, then Korea, then Southeast Asia, and now China. And this is the important thing. The bulk of our demand, the growth that has been seen in India, is the demand for that is coming from within the country. Our consumption rates are going up very fast, and now increasingly our investment rates are also going up very fast. The old pattern used to be something like 75 to 80% was consumption, and the balance, 20-odd percent, was investment. It's begun to change, and now savings and investment are in the 30-35% range. Consumption, although growing in absolute numbers very rapidly, in fact, the retail sector is growing at 20% on a base of $300 billion. It's still a very large... Now, the importance of this feature is that the Indian economy is relatively, therefore, immune to shocks from the external world. If any of you are apprehensive about an American slowdown or a slowdown in the Asia-Pacific region, in India, we are well positioned to act as a counter-cyclical hedge in exactly this kind of situation. The second feature, of course, which has been fairly well remarked upon, is that services are the leading sector in the Indian economy. Last financial year, services accounted for 55% of the GDP, which is an unusual percentage for a country at our level of development. We are a trillion-dollar economy now. And yet, this is again a reflection of the fact that in our country, education and knowledge have been put to work in a far more effective way than the manufacturing sector, which is not to say that manufacturing is not doing well. I think there is a sense that manufacturing in India is not doing well. That isn't entirely true. The low end of the manufacturing chain is certainly not doing very well. So we're not producing a lot of T-shirts and sneakers. But the engineering range, the technical range of manufactured goods, such as automobiles, auto parts, chemicals, pharmaceuticals, they're doing extremely well. Okay, here we are. I think this is things that I have already touched upon. These are some of the macroeconomic indicators also which I've touched upon. I think the point I would make going back here is that the sector which is holding back the economy is agriculture. This in two ways. Number one, something like 55% of the population of India still derives its primary livelihood from agriculture. And the second is, of course, that agriculture is not doing as well as it should. The reason for this is to be found in our history. The colonial system that we inherited depended upon a lot of large land-owning families. They were called zamindars. And it was based on a fairly ruthless exploitation of the cultivator. So when we gained independence, one of the first things that Prime Minister Nehru did was to introduce land reforms, abolish this system of zamindari, and give the land to the tiller. This was, of course, socially a very popular step and socially just. But what it did was it fragmented the farms. The result is that our farming is still on very small patches of individually owned land, and there isn't enough commercialization there. This is one of the challenges that we are facing right now. And I have been reporting back to Delhi that Australia is a country that has a very well-developed agriculture and a very well-developed post-harvest technologies. This is important again for us because even what we produce, something like 30% of perishables are wasted, spoiled, and something like 10% of the non-perishables are also wasted, which in a country that has as much hunger as we have is something we can ill afford. Now, We have, this is a brief reference to the sort of targets that we have set for ourselves. We still have five-year plans, but they are not the old GOS plan kind of thing, which incidentally we never had. And a lot of it is drawn up in consultation with the private sector. And the, as you all know, the current Prime Minister is the father of the economic reforms. He had a very able lieutenant who was the finance secretary when the Prime Minister was the finance minister, named Montek Singh Ahluwalia. He is the chairman of the, he's the deputy chairman of the Planning Commission. And if Prime Minister Manmohan Singh is the father, I always say Montek was probably the uncle of the reform program. And so he's the one who's really driving the reforms that very obviously we need to undertake as part of our second generation and to further the growth process. A little bit about our external sector. Exports have been growing very rapidly, even though we still remain largely focused on domestic consumption. Our total trade turnover is now of the order of $400 billion at the end of the financial year 07. Foreign investment is growing. Here one sees an interesting variation again from the typical developing country model. We are not only attracting investment inwards, we are also, our firms are also investing overseas. It might interest you to know that in 2005, the largest foreign investor in the UK was India. And my guess is that this year again, that is 07, again India is going to be the largest investor in Britain, because right as early as January, one of our firms, the Tatas, who I'm, at least some of you would have heard of, bought the largest steel company in Britain for a deal worth $8 billion US. So what is happening in India is that we are attracting inward investment, largely portfolio investment. Not much of it is FDI. A lot of it is portfolio. And we are exporting capital in a big way too. The last number, for example, you will see the non-resident deposits alone are $37.8 billion in one financial year. A lot of it is then exported out again. So that's why in our net figures, it's just about, I would guess, something between $20 and $25 billion, which again, for an economy of our size, is a pretty healthy rate of inward investment, net inward investment as well. Speaking of which, we have... The figures in the High Commission are that we have something like $3 billion invested in Australia, most of it in the extractive industries, but a lot of it in services too. And investments from Australia into India are of the order of about $2 billion. So in the case of Australia, India is a net investor into Australia. This is a reference to the increasing rate of savings. There is a proposal to develop Mumbai as a financial hub. This was put in a statement made by the finance minister in the budget last year. And then for 1 year, an expert panel has been working on it. I know that Australia has a very advanced financial sector. This may be something that would be worth your while to look into. If any of you have any further interest in this, I'd be very happy to share the report that has been drawn up by the Committee of Experts on building Mumbai as a financial hub. Foreign exchange, human development. Now, this is one factor on which, feature on which I'd like to dwell a little bit, because in India there's certainly a very heated debate going on whether the kind of growth rates that we have seen, has it been inclusive? What has it meant for the poorer sections of Indian society? And the debate goes on. Amartya Sen, who taught me in the Delhi School of Economics, has written a book called The Argumentative Indian. So we will continue to argue, but you can see at least some of the facts are in. And it indicates that the incidence of poverty is, that is, people living below the poverty line, and this is the World Bank definition of poverty line, is now 22%. It was 50% in 1947 when we gained independence. It was stubbornly stuck between 40 and 50% up until 1991 when the reform program began. And it has almost halved in the last 17 years. So I would say there is clear evidence that it is making a dent in poverty. Not as fast, not as deep as we would want it to be, but it is making a difference. Similarly, on employment figures also, we find that employment rates are going up as well. After having been stagnant in the early period through the 90s, they are going up again now, and therefore we are making a dent in the unemployment in the country as well. Here's a little look at the financial services. The important point I would highlight is the non-performing assets. Our Reserve Bank has been extremely strict with the commercial banks. We have Indian state-owned banks, we have Indian private banks, and we have foreign banks. So we have three categories of banks in the country, all governed by the Reserve Bank's very stringent requirements. So the NPAs are just 2%. Now this, I think, is something which makes our banks very attractive partners for the Australian financial sector. And you can see, similarly, the story with regard to the insurance sector and the stock markets. Stock markets are booming like they are pretty much all over the Asia-Pacific, in fact, pretty much all over the world. We are also in record territory, over 14,000. It was 4,000 in 2004 when this government came to office. So that gives you some idea. It's been a little gone up by about three and a half times in the 3 years that this government has been in office. This is a reflection of the government focus on agriculture. I stress this because, as I said, it is a very large, it has enormous social implications for the country. And also with 55% of the vote, it's a very important political force as well. Also the mainstay, really, of the current government. The bulk of their votes come from the rural areas, and therefore it's a place where good politics and good economics intersect. A little word on the foreign policy framework. We initiated the Look East policy in the early 90s, after the end of the Cold War. Like Australia before that, we also tended to look west whenever we thought of foreign policy. Europe, Russia, America, these were our traditional partners where most of the engagement was. Luckily, it has changed. I had the privilege to be part of the group that formulated the new policies, and then I moved to Singapore and then here to see how the policy has worked and how it is being implemented. And I'm glad to say that with most, it has been a great success. We have annual summits with ASEAN. We have an FTA we are negotiating an FTA with ASEAN. And we have what we call comprehensive economic cooperation agreements with Thailand and Singapore. And of course, I think what I would consider the crowning glory, in the year, financial year 04-05, for the first time, our trade with the East exceeded our trade with the West. I think this is really a sort of turning point in our Look East policy. A brief look at some of the priority areas. In all this good news, infrastructure is certainly one of the most shameful aspects of the Indian economy. Fortunately, all the policymakers are deeply, deeply aware of this. And issues like power generation, ports, roads, airports are getting top priority attention right now. For the power sector alone in the next 5 years, our Prime Minister has said we are going to have to invest something like $300 billion. All the dollars here, by the way, are US dollars. Most of our reckoning is in either rupees or dollars. $300 billion over the next 5 years. Of which we are going to be able to raise about $260 billion domestically, which means there's an uncovered gap of $40 billion over 5 years. The Electricity Act permits private sector operations at all parts of the chain, from production to distribution to retail. And of course, the big challenge is to find how to fire these plants, which are on the drawing boards. We are deeply conscious of our environmental responsibility, even though we are exempt under the Kyoto Protocol from targets. That doesn't mean that we are polluting right and left. We have a very active NGO sector in this area. And in fact, the chairman of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is an Indian and has been talking about the need for clean development for at least the last 20 years. Our focus was on LNG and hydroelectric power and nuclear power, but the fact is that the prices are such and the availability is such that we are going to continue to use coal as the mainstay. Coal accounts for about 65% right now, and my estimate would be that that's how it will stay. Retail I have briefly touched upon, so we can skip this. Pharma and healthcare. Media and entertainment is another area that's growing very fast. You see some of the numbers here. Star TV gets about 60% of its Asian revenues from India alone. We now permit foreign investment in the print media. The Indian movie industry, of course, is very well known. And you'd be happy to know that the first full-length feature film was shot in Australia some 2 years back. This was in Melbourne. And there's a very amusing footnote to the shooting. The plot requires the student to be a medical student, and obviously these guys didn't know their geography very well, so they have him living in Ballarat, and he cycles to the La Trobe University every morning. And anyway, the interesting thing is that La Trobe don't have a medical faculty. And so they put up all those plaques, you know, oncology, dentistry, outpatients, and all that. And it's complete fake. And the vice chancellor told me that after the movie was shot, they had now applied for a license to open a medical school. So that's the power of Bollywood. Tourism is growing well too, and the numbers to Australia are increasing. Numbers from Australia are increasing. I think we can do a lot better if visas and air services were to be improved. So here you are. Here's my summary, and thank you.